Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Sports Ethos Los Angeles Chargers podcast. We have been recording in the middle of Sunday Night Football for the last few weeks because the games are rough, including the Seahawks-Packers one and probably Cowboys-Bucks next week. I wouldn't be surprised if we record even earlier. Oh, God. Yeah, we're about 10-26 in the third here, 20-3 Packers. Brandon, this is basically kind of showcased our frustrations with the Seahawks so far this year.
Yeah, you know, I think this is also the earliest that we've started the pod, both for the year and for, like, you know, game length wise, starting it, you know, this early in the game. But yeah, this is what I said on the pod, last pod back, you know, a couple days ago. I said, you know, if Geno Smith has to play basically perfect football for the Seahawks to win anything. And, like, I don't mean just, like, one turnover and he can get away with. No, I mean he has to literally not turn the ball over, period, for the Seahawks to win.
Yeah, you're in the red zone and you're turning it over. You're letting – and with Seattle, like, you're opening the game with letting Josh Jacobs gas you for a touchdown. Like, yeah, this defense is good. It's very good. But the word inconsistent keeps coming to mind, especially when you're playing a good offense like the Packers, which, yeah, we talked about that they are very young. And I think all those points that we made at the Packers last week or 2 weeks ago kind of still stands. There's not much new about the Packers at this point. But when you're playing a team that's this young and you're expected to be a top three defense, this inconsistency just can't happen. This is what it is. It literally cannot happen if you're the Seahawks.
Yeah, no, especially a team that has made their identity for years off of, you know, defensive football and you know, being one of those teams that can get big stops and, you know, the whole Legion of Boom and when Bobby Wagner was there, but even when Matt Hasselbeck was there, they still had a decent, not as great as it was in the last decade plus, but still they've always had a decent defense. I mean, this year, it's been up and down. It's been a lot of games where they play really well. But here's the thing. When they play really good defense, the offense doesn't have to do a whole lot, and that kind of masks a lot of the deficiencies in the offense, a lot of the kind of ball security issues that we talk about, a lot of the kind of the, you know, being plagued by, you know, a couple injuries here and there. When we talk about, you know, Seattle has to be a defense first kind of team in order to win anything. And tonight, when you're getting gashed like this by the Packers, you know, listen, they can still come back. I mean, it's still early enough, but I don't think they will. I mean, you're down three scores and the Packers are just better than what you think.
I agree. Like, we'll see how this progresses, but yeah, I mean, I think if you're a Seahawks fan, this has to be extremely frustrating. Because you look at this team and you're like, yeah, this is a playoff team, but this is a playoff team that I think realistically, I don't even think they can win a wild card game at home against most of the NFC at this point. I really don't. And I think that's a very scary thing, at least here in the middle of the third quarter, to think about.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, that's why I said I think the only chance that they can win a playoff game win the division and have a home game. That's it.
And even that is a tough task because you're talking about this Packers team that is quintessentially the primary wildcard team in the NFC right now, and you're doing this so far in this game.
Yeah, it's you know, when you are a team that's pretty much like you're on the verge of making the playoffs, we only have 3 weeks left. Which is crazy to say. This season flew by compared to last year. Because last year felt like the season from hell that would never end. But this year, you know, you're on the verge of being 8-6. Like, you're still going to make the playoffs, but you're going to kind of make it as, what, maybe 10-7, 9-8? And then you're looking at, you know, are you good enough to beat, you know, the Packers in the playoffs? Like, you know, you're not going to play them, you know, round one probably, but when you make it, it's like, you can't beat the Packers. You can't beat the Vikings. You can't beat the Lions. You're not going to beat the Eagles. You're not, like, There's already like at least four or five teams in the NFC, not even in football, in the NFC alone that are better than you at doing the little things too, unforced errors. Like, you know, a lot of the mistakes they make, you know, it's a lot of Geno Smith turning the ball over. It's just, it is what it is. You know, like they had a couple of good games the last couple of weeks. He wasn't turning the ball over. I mean, there weren't any fumbles or any real drop issues from the wide receivers. So they were playing, you know, mistake free football, and the defense was playing, you know, good defense. So, but it almost feels like the Seahawks have to play a perfect game to win. And that's not conducive to winning a Super Bowl or hell, even making even winning a playoff game in the NFL. You can't have to always play a perfect game to win and think that you're going to go for.
And look, even if they do come back in this game, I think it still stands. I still feel the same way about this team, even if they do find a way to come back here. And like, they can drive down the field. I mean, they're doing it right now. They can drive down the field with JSN and Lockett and DK, but it's just not consistent enough. And that's the biggest thing. Two other teams that I feel similarly about, even though they're in two separate conferences, is the Bucs and the Chargers. And they played today. And, you know, the Buccaneers, like, took a little bit of time, but they got there. We've talked about how great Mike Evans is. But now I'm kind of just completely out on them as, like, because now I'm starting to think, like, which teams can legitimately win a playoff game, right, in both conferences. Mm-hmm. And to me, when I think about the Bucs and the Chargers and watching that today, I don't think they can. And Geno's hurt now. He's limping. Oh, no. Oh, no. That's not good. Sam Howell, that's not going to make it much better if the offensive line is that bad. He got walloped in the leg. But with the Bucs and the Chargers, like, I feel the same way as I do with the Seahawks, where it's just like, even if you have a home playoff game, like, this doesn't feel great. And I guess same with the Texans too, but I feel at least somewhat confident that the Texans can win a playoff game after winning the South. Like, winning one, I don't think is out of the question for them. With the Bucs and the Chargers, I'm worried about them even winning one at this point.
Yeah, it just feels very, very much the same. Like the Bucs and Chargers, they have a type of a team that could win a playoff game, like, just based on the talent that they have. But I look at them and I'm like, well, they've both dealt with a good bit of injuries this year. They've both have had inconsistencies on both sides of the ball. They've both, you know, their coaching is still kind of trying to grind through games every week. You can't win a game. You can't win. And that's just like with the Seahawks. You can't win, you know, much in this league if you're constantly grinding out games. It does take its toll. And every week, you know, especially with these two teams, I mean, I know they played each other today, but, you know, I'm kind of pissed that I picked that as my game of the week now, because
it wasn't that great. Because it
didn't tell me anything different about what these two teams kind of are. Like, you know, the score had, you know, the Chargers charged, you know, they gave up 27, you know, points. They didn't score at all in the second half, and they gave up 27 points in the second half. They were up, you know, 17-13 at halftime. So the fact that you gave up 27 unanswered, pretty much, and I don't know if it was unanswered, but I know, like, but regardless, giving up 27
pretty much was like even if it wasn't, it felt like it watching the game. I was like, dude, like, you're being competitive for like maybe a quarter and a half, and then yikes. Like, that's what it felt like to me.
Yeah. Like, it's just, you know, the Chargers just don't have an identity yet.
It's Sam Howell at QB. Geno is in immense pain right now. So that is pretty big.
But yeah, the only problem, and the thing is too, I think the biggest thing with these two teams, with the Bucs and Chargers, they just don't have an identity. There's no identity. And you look at all the good teams, like in the NFL, there's a certain identity there. Like, you know, we know what the Chiefs are. We know what the Eagles are. We know what the Lions are. We know what the Bills are. You know, we know what the Vikings are. We know what the Packers are. Like, we know what all these different teams are. But, you know, you're looking at a couple playoff teams, like in the Bucs, who probably will win that, you know, they'll win that division at this point, I think. And then the Chargers, who should, you know, now they might not make the playoffs because, you know, them and the Broncos are fighting for second place in the division.
Yeah.
And I mean, and not for nothing, the Broncos won today. So, you know, now they're in third in the division. So now you're really fighting for that last season, or, you know, as we come down the wire, down the stretch here. So it's tough because I really expected more from the Chargers today. And I don't understand why they never kicked it into gear. But all I know is that when it comes to these two teams, they're the ones, like, you know, them, you know, like a lot of those teams that are fighting for those wild card spots. There's a big gap this year between the wild card teams and the ones that are division winners. And I feel like, but the problem is with the NFC South, the Bucks are a division winner every year, but we know they're not good.
Do you feel that same way about the Texans? Because I'm like kind of wishy-washy with them. Like, I feel like they can win a game, but I also wouldn't be surprised if they don't. Like, do you feel similarly about Houston after today?
I mean, looking at how the AFC is, like, could they beat the Ravens? Yeah, but I don't think it's likely, just given how CJ Stroud has played this year. Could they beat the Bills? No. Could they beat the Chiefs if they played them? No. Could they beat the Steelers? Maybe. But with that defense, I don't think so. Depending on how healthy the Steelers are. There's already, you know, about three teams I'm already saying that they're not better than. Like, so they could probably win a playoff game, but because they're going to win their division, so they're going to get a home game, but I can't see them getting much further than the wild card. I think in division, I think whoever they play in division is going to kill them. So I really can't see further for, you know, much further for them after that.
Yeah. And then continuing with our division that we, I guess don't cover the most, but are playing up with the Chargers, the Chiefs, Patrick Mahomes, injury, soreness, high ankle sprain. We'll learn more tomorrow. The Chiefs, I believe it's the Chiefs, the Steelers. Oh my God, another PI on the Seahawks defensively. Jesus, big problem today. The PI call, Jesus, so it's bad. This defense is getting roughed up. Yes, we're reacting light of the game. Sue us, okay? We're doing this during the game. But with the Chiefs, right? Three, I believe the Steelers and the Ravens are kind of in the same boat, if I'm not mistaken. I know the Steelers are. Brandon, you got three games in 11 days. You got, particularly, we're focused on the Chiefs next or on Saturday. Yeah, you know, the early window on Saturday in, you know, against the Texans. And then you turn around and have the shortest window ever playing on Christmas on that Wednesday. Like, that alone is such a crazy time frame. And again, like, maybe the silver lining with Mahomes is like, hey, we need him healthy for the playoffs, not now. Do you kind of feel that same way, knowing how crazy their schedule looks here coming up over the next 11 days here?
I mean, you know, the next, you know, they've got a real tough stretch. And, you know, it's not even like they're playing. You know, because the three games, 11 days is awkward no matter how you slice it, but it's like you're not playing a Sunday game and then a Thursday game and then another game. You're playing a Saturday game, a Wednesday game on Christmas, and then, you know, January 5th. So you're playing a super, super weird stretch. And the thing is, you know, can they beat the Texans without Patrick Mahomes? I don't think so. I mean, I know. No, like, it's tough because Carson Wentz is a veteran, but Carson Wentz is not the quarterback for that team. Like, we talk about Patrick Mahomes having a lot of luck this season, but Patrick Mahomes is still Patrick Mahomes. He still makes the plays when he needs to. And it depends. We got to see if he plays or not at this point, which it's not looking likely that he's going to play next week.
I'm not even just thinking next week. How likely is it? Again, we have to see what it is, and we'll update it as we go tomorrow. But you're talking about, as you said, Saturday and into Wednesday. That's a crazy turnaround. That's a turnaround that with a high ankle sprain, most guys just can't do. So you're going to run with Carson Wentz for two straight weeks, essentially, of NFL football. Like, that's tough.
Against two teams with playoff experience. It's not like you're playing, the Jaguars and the Titans. No, you're playing, the Texans. I mean, down here, but it's still the Texans. And you're playing the Texans, and you gotta go on the road in Pittsburgh to play. You're not at home for that game. You're in Pittsburgh to play the Steelers. So, if that's a home game, I'm thinking a little bit differently. But the thing is, if TJ Watt's healthy, I think they lose that game because TJ Watt damn near, for a couple quarters, he made that Eagles game a little bit close. And with how much the Chiefs really can't score offensively, I take their game, against the Browns today, with a little bit of salt because, they didn't have to score a lot. They scored, enough, but, they could have scored more if they wanted to. I mean, Mahomes went down, but he didn't have a great game today. Jameis Winston threw three picks. That was really the story of this game. I just look at the Chiefs and I'm like, you can't count them out because we talk about they got that devil magic. We make fun of that. But I mean, if anybody's going to have that kind of luck, it's the Chiefs.
Is it Krampus like in Red One when we get to that at some point this week? Is it Krampus? Is that what it is?
Oh, God. Like, the good thing is they have a two-game lead in the AFC in the seeding. They have a two-game lead over the Bills right now. So they could probably – here's the problem. If you start Carson Wentz and you don't win against the Texans, then you're – all of a sudden you're in trouble because going against a good Steelers defense and George Pickens will be back for that game, barring any setbacks, that's a game you could easily lose. And then all of a sudden you might have the luxury of resting your starters, especially if the Bills are like a game behind or whatever it is. You do not have the luxury of resting your starters the final week of the season unless it's truly wrapped up. So if Mahomes has to play a final week of the season and having that game be a division game against the Broncos, who are, they have been hot the second half of the season, then I don't know. That's a real tricky, slippery slope to navigate. And that's where, they're going to run into issues. It's going to be a real, this next game is going to tell us, and especially with the Bills too, how they play their next game, is going to tell us a lot about where these two teams are going to line up the last 2 weeks. So, we can't kind of predict too far into the future because Mahomes could be fine in 2 weeks. I mean, I think it's a pretty safe bet he's not going to play this game against the Texans. So there's that. But at the same time, you lose that game, all of a sudden, let's say Mahomes isn't healthy, let's just say, do you start pressing? Do you start kind of worrying about, oh boy, especially if the Bills win? I mean, they just knocked off the Lions today. The Bills can, they get the Patriots next week. They're going to win that game. That's a home game. They're going to beat the Patriots. So all of a sudden now, let's say, so it's a very it's a possible outcome to where the Bills could steal that first seed that the Chiefs held all year because Patrick Mahomes gets hurt.
Yeah. And again, I talked to you about this like earlier today because now that we're close to Christmas, like we're thinking about that game, right? That game is in 10 days' time here, right? we're thinking about that game very strictly because with that short of a schedule, I'm scared of what other injuries they might cop. That's a incredibly tight schedule. So I'm really worried about it. Like I and people might say like Saturday to Wednesday, whatever, like some people play, you know, Sunday to Thursday. I'm like, dude, you're playing a 125 on a Saturday and you gotta come and do basically well what is it? Yeah, like a 1 Eastern, and then you got to do the same thing in 5, like 4. It's tough. It's a tough schedule. Like that's tough sledding. Like it just is. It's very different. So I'm worried about that piece as well.
You know, it's when you have a schedule, like it's one thing to play, you know, 3 games in 21 days, a normal schedule. But the worst part is because they're playing 1 o'clock games, not even 1:30, 1 o'clock. So those games are kicking off at 1:05. So it's not like he would even have, like Patrick Mahomes himself would have the whole day to, like, let's say it was a night game. Let's say it was a Sunday night game or whatever it was. He doesn't have the luxury, or even just any night game, because even on a Saturday, I believe they've played night games as we get close to the end of the season.
Yeah, they're going to do it like the last couple weeks of the year. But yeah, because of the college football playoff kind of merging into that schedule next on Saturday, at this point, they're only doing 2 games. That's why it's a morning game and an afternoon game, because the college football playoff is kind of interplaying into that a little bit. So that's also part of it from a logistical standpoint. So yeah.
These next 2 games are 1 o'clock games, and Chiefs Broncos, that one's probably gonna be a 4:30 game, given that it's a division game and given how well the two teams have played. So I guarantee that game will be a 4:30. But these next 2 weeks, these 1 o'clock, you know, not even 2 weeks, this next week and a half, because they're playing 2 games in a week and a half, those are 1 o'clock games, you know. So it's like it's not like he's got the whole day to rest, you know, and it's a night game. It's like that little extra rest can make a big difference, especially with a sprain. So it's going to be real tough to see how they navigate this. And I think it's just gonna be real tough in general to see if they can win. I mean, you're like I said, you're not playing cupcake teams. You're playing 3 tough teams the last 3 games. So, and I mean, they're gonna lose another game. I don't think there's any way you can play 3 games in 11 days with how banged up Mahomes is too, and win all 3. I don't think that's a possibility.
And I don't think it's a possibility for anyone. I think it's the same for Pittsburgh and Baltimore. It's not a possibility to win all 3. It's very hard. This is such an unorthodox schedule for that reason. And again, it's really bad for the teams. It's really bad. It's really bad for league. Like, it's bad. It's really bad, especially towards the end of the year. But it's Christmas and they want games, and Netflix paid them a pretty penny. So there you go. But yeah, it sucks. Are you ready for dumb stuff? This is the worst week of dumb stuff since the Chicago Bears blunder on Thanksgiving, by far. This is 2 of like the worst things. One of them is one of the worst things I've ever seen. The other one is like, I'm tired of it and we need to talk about it. Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. Dan flipping Campbell. Fourth quarter, 12 minutes left. Hypothetically, like, look, Josh Allen, but hypothetically, you can get a stop and win that game. And you tell me what, they only lost by 7 in the end. The logistics of an onside kick are different. The teams know you're kicking it. The percentage is so incredibly low from an analytical standpoint. What the hell was he thinking?
Your guess is as good as mine.
It's not even, this is one of those rare cases in the NFL where, you know, you could make a case that a lot of things in the NFL are defensible. Like that Bears blunder was indefensible. This to me weirdly feels more indefensible. Like there's no defense, Brandon, to this. Like it was such a bold, but also it was bold, it was brazen, and it was flat out dumb. And this is what we worry about with Dan Campbell, and it rears its ugly head. And what I would argue is the most important game for the Lions, in the sense that it's only about being competitive. You win that game, you put yourself up a spot, but you already know that you can beat one of the best teams in the NFL. And a huge reason you lost is because Dan Campbell, once again, is just being way too bold for his own good. And this is an onside kick that the other team knows is going to happen because of the new rule set. What in the world, dude?
It's we've been very clear about this since even last season when it hurt them in the playoffs. I mean, it wasn't just his decision making, it was just players not making plays. But the problem is, you put your players in a bad spot when you're putting a lot of pressure on them in different situations to convert, whether that's an onside kick, a fourth down and long, whatever it may be. Here's the issue. We've said it all along. Dan Campbell's over-aggressive. And honestly, Dan Campbell's over-aggressiveness at this point is worse than Nick Sirianni. I never thought I'd say that in my life, but
like,
it is.
If I'm the Lions brass, I am sitting down with Dan Campbell tomorrow and be like, dude, you cannot do this anymore. Like, we like it, but dude, like, statistically speaking, this is an onside kick when your team has a chance to win. You can't just be bold and say, oh, I thought we were going to recover it. No, dude, no,
that's not how the game's played. And the thing is, like, it's not like you're down 10 with like 4 minutes to go and you have to do it there basically at that time. You have a whole basically a quarter left.
You have the whole flipping quarter, literally the whole quarter.
Well, like, I know I know in his head he's probably thinking, oh, we can't stop Josh Allen, we can't stop their offense. But the thing is, it doesn't make sense, because in an onside kick, especially when you're declaring it, so the other team knows it's going to happen, so they're even more prepared for it. You're only down by 10 with basically a whole quarter, or 75% of a quarter. No, 80%, because it's 4 out of 5. So you have 80% of that quarter remaining. You have plenty of time. It's only a 10-point game. Anything can happen. An interception, a fumble. Like those are a lot higher chances of happening, or even just getting a stop on defense and getting a 3-and-out in like less than 2 or 3 minutes, and you'd still have 9 minutes left to go on the field and at least kick a field goal to make it a 1-possession game. So there's a lot. Everything else was a higher percentage chance of happening in that situation than you recovering an onside kick. And then the worst part is, now you don't get it. Not only is it returned. Return for a TD?
It was returned to the 5-yard line. Your own fucking basically. 5. The Lions 5. Yeah, it was basically a touchdown.
Yeah, basically a touchdown. So, you know, here's the thing. Even if the Bills just fall on it, you are giving them the ball at midfield. You're basically giving them the ball at midfield. So,
or the 30.
Yeah, or even the 30, if it doesn't even go 10 yards. You know, I didn't see the onside kick, but even so, regardless, you are giving the Bills a great field position regardless in a 10-point game where you can just kick that ball away, make them drive the length of the field, and anything can happen. You're not out of the game. There's 12 minutes left. That kind of reasoning, like, everybody's like, oh, well, you know, the Bills are beating up on them, you know, all game. But here's the thing. When you have a chance to come back in a game as a team, you've got to play smart football, not aggressive to the point of a fault. And that's what that is. And I said it, what, last week? I think I said it 2 weeks ago. Dan Campbell's aggressiveness is nice, but it's mostly 90% of the time, or not even 90, I'd say 99% of the time, it's aggressiveness to a fault. That's the issue.
Yeah. Like this just pissed me off. Cause I'm like, dude, again, people said this online and this is true. You're not goofing off and playing Madden, right? You're not. You're playing real football against real life players. And again, yes, it's Josh Allen. But what message are you telling your defense by kicking an onside kick there? I don't believe you can stop Josh Allen. What message does that send? And then if you kick it, and then as it happened, the Bills got the ball back, you're sending that message to your defense as they're going out onto the damn field. Like, what are you doing?
What was I saying before? You're basically admitting defeat by doing that there. You're showing your players that you do not care. When you play, you cannot play reckless football and expect to win. When it works, it looks great. And they've done a lot of that. It's worked, and it's worked well. Well, here's the issue. It's starting to not work now, and it cost them today. And it cost them last year in the playoffs, and it cost them...
In the playoffs, in an NFC championship game. But it wasn't even... But that's the thing that I think we're both trying to emphasize here, which is the important thing. This is... Most of the stuff that Dan Campbell's done, I can sit here and have a defense. I can be like, you know what? That's what he is. That's whatever, right? An onside kick in that position is the most indefensible thing. Even I can't come on here and defend it. I can't. I can't defend that at all.
It's like, because there's no way you can... Usually when a coach makes a bad decision, there's usually some way, some way, shape, or form you can spin it or try to answer the questions and kind of dance around it. It's like he's lucky the team is where they are, because if that was any other situation, like any other year, you'd get fired for that. You would get fired.
Yeah.
That's not good enough. And the thing is, if that situation comes up in the playoffs, what's stopping him from doing it again? If he's that bold to do that when he's got all this playoff seeding on the line and the division is still on the line and all these different things, if he's that bold enough to do it there, and he was bold enough to do it last year, what's going to stop him from doing it again this year against a better defense than let's say the Bills, like a better overall team than the Bills? And like, if you do that against the Eagles, I'm sorry, you're gonna lose.
I'm gonna be real. I think if you look at the majority of the NFC, let's just think about the NFC in general. If you do that against the majority of the NFC in the playoffs, because as much as we've talked about the Eagles and the Lions and the Bills, now I think deserve to be in that conversation after today. Mm-hmm. Which, I mean, clearly they do. We can't dismiss it. They definitely do. That's the thing. Like, I sit here and go, there are years like this where we're so confident in the top tier of the NFL. But it's the playoffs. Upsets happen. Weird crap happens sometimes, right? So even if you play a Tampa Bay... Hell, if you play Seattle, a Green Bay, whatever it is, like, that can cost you in a divisional round game out of nowhere. Like, that's my extra worry. It's like, dude, we're in a position where we're so confident about the top tier in the league. And yes, look, the Bills 100% deserve to be there. They've shown that over the last 2 weeks, especially, but especially tonight, they showed that they belong. We definitely are seeing that. That's 100% there. But on years like this, crap can just happen. So who does that fall on? Dan Campbell. If you're going to be brazen and go for that, guess what? Crap can happen to you at any moment in the playoffs.
You know, we've kind of seen him build this culture with this team over the last, you know, 2.5 years. And we look at how, like, it never bit them in the backside until last, you know, playoffs, until the NFC Championship game. And we saw what happened. But the thing is, a good coach learns from that. Like, you can be aggressive. You just can't be, and I've said this before, you just can't be aggressive to a fault. When you are overly aggressive to the point of being stupid, it's going to hurt you. I don't care how much talent you have. I don't care if you can hang 40, 50 on an opponent every week. You're going to go against a good team, and that crap's not going to fly at all.
You're going to go against an average team in the playoffs, and that crap could bite you in the ass. Yeah. Like, this is, like, bro.
Especially when you know how injured your team is, too, and they're getting, you know, they're
getting
not healthy.
They're getting more injured. They're one of their best D linemen in McNeil, who they just signed, and one of their linebackers got hurt, and both are probably out for the year. You're getting even more injured defensively.
Yeah, it's one thing when I look at coaches that I understand what the records are, what they are, and things like that, right? But you got to look deeper and deeper issues. It's why I look at Kyle Shanahan the same way. It's why I look at guys like Todd Bowles, who still find a way to win a division or make the playoffs despite being 9-8 every year. I look at coaches, to me, record, and we've said this before, records, you know, just like, you know, numbers only tell you half the story. You've got to look at how the team is constructed and what their head coach is asking of them. And here's the problem. I look at Dan Campbell the same way I look at Shanahan, the same way I look at Todd Bowles. Just that they have different cultures. That's what sets them apart, and the player and then also different rosters. But I look at them as the same types of head coaches. They are, you know, their players, you know, go to war for them. Like Todd Bowles, even though we still talk about him not being the best, I think he still does have respect for that locker room. Those guys, you know, especially the guys that have been there long enough, they know the kind of guy he is. That culture is still all right there. But Dan Campbell's culture, we know what his culture is. It's great there. We know Kyle Shanahan's culture is. You know, we understand that. The guy's been in two Super Bowls. You know, this guy knows what it takes to get there. But here's the issue with all of those guys. And it's one word. It's aggressiveness. And it's Dan Campbell is aggressive to a fault with his decision making. Kyle Shanahan is aggressive in how he manages his players and runs them into the ground. Todd Bowles is just aggressive in the fact that he can kind of be standoffish and a little cold, and he doubles down on that. But he's also aggressive when the same thing with Shanahan. It's the player management side of things. And even now Dan Campbell is starting to fall into that. I like him, but his player management also isn't great because now these guys are starting to, you know, catch injuries left and right, and he's still kind of doubling down on what he's been doing. When you can kind of see some cracks in a foundation with teams, you've got to do your best to patch them up, not continue to keep going until it breaks. And with Dan Campbell's, you know, with his aggressiveness and things like that, it's going to break the same way it's broke for Kyle Shanahan, the same way that it's just not working for Todd Bowles.
I was gonna say, let's actually shift into that before we do the second of dumb stuff. Another guy we have to add to the list again is Sirianni. And we can start with just this entire week for Philly was a mess. And it felt like it's always been a mess, and it's like leaking and leaking and leaking and leaking. And look, like, today was a patchwork day. It helped, but like, I think you see it a lot more than I do, that there it's not just Sirianni and the culture. It's these internal pieces with the players that still don't feel right necessarily. And it's scary. Like, it doesn't, it is Sirianni at its core, but I think it's also just leaking to the players even after today's win. Do you feel the same way?
I feel like today was a good first step. I mean, this is the most I've seen the guys smile. Like, listen, they've won 10 straight, but I think out of the 10 straight, this is the most that they've smiled and kind of partied and had fun after a win. And that's because you beat up on a good team. You beat up on a really good team. Also, you swept the AFC North. That's something to that is huge. But I look at it, and it's every week I know this team can beat anybody. I've said that since Jalen Hurts has been the damn quarterback of the Philadelphia Eagles. So it's basically since the end of 21 when they went on that run and made the playoffs. I said, I will put this current era of the Philadelphia Eagles, I'll put them up against anybody because I know they can beat anybody. I've seen it. I know what this team can be. And today was the most complete game they've played all season long. Here's the problem, though. They have a lot of stars. I love the talent that we have. But it feels like Sirianni can't manage. Like, these guys don't have egos in the sense that they're bad egos. But they have egos in the sense that when things flare up because they want to win, it's not so much them being a diva. It's because they all want to win, but they all want to do their part in winning. That it feels like Sirianni can't keep control of each of the guys' egos. And I feel like we see it every week. Whether that's, you know, AJ Brown, you know, complain a little bit about the passing game, which they did fix today, but complained a little bit about it. Or whether it was, you know, like CJ Gardner-Johnson had said, you know, after the Super Bowl 2 years ago, he was like, you know, coaching didn't put us in a good position to win the game. And I was like, that's a real damning, you know, that's damning of Jonathan Gannon, but that was also damning of Nick Sirianni too. I also feel like, you know, I think this is the most fun this team has had in a while. But the thing is, even if they win big, whether that's, you know, 2-3 scores, whatever it is, like it was against the Rams, like it's a fun game to watch, but it feels like they still could be doing more and it could be looking more effortless and things could be more streamlined. And it's that starts with the coaching. Like today, I love Jalen Carter. I love how physical and how dominant he is. And the thing is, to me, I think he's the best defensive tackle in football right now. Because every week he's doing something crazy that's, you know, a couple times a game that impacts a game, whether it's QB pressure, sacks, forced fumble, whatever it is, hawking down running backs, you know. So, but he has an attitude issue. We've known this. And it hasn't reared its ugly head yet. He hasn't been penalized heavily for it yet. But he took a swing at a Steelers offensive lineman for no reason. On the 4th-and-7 on a punt, he is lucky that I said it before. I told you before we came on. He's lucky that ball got kicked before he did that, because otherwise that would have flipped the whole game on its head. Because you would have gave them a 1st-and-10, damn near in the red zone, down by 14, and they could. I mean, not saying they would have scored a touchdown, but that could have given them a lot of momentum to score a touchdown and make that game a one possession game with still, you know, not what. 9-10 minutes left on the clock, and then you're starting to stress out. So it's, you know, there's times, and the thing is, he goes over to Jalen Carter and everybody's like, he's going over there to talk to him, but that's not what it looked like. He went over there to yell at him, to scream at him, because you could see his face was turning red on the sideline. I saw it live. I know what I saw. My eyes don't deceive me. It did not look like that was a friendly conversation they were about to get into. It looked like he was going to get in his face. And Jalen Carter, given, you know, some of the past kind of issues, that's the wrong guy to get into the face of. You've got to. But here's the problem. When you're not respected in the locker room, and we've said that culture matters, when you aren't respected by your players, those things like that tend to happen a lot. And his tenure as Eagles head coach has been marked by that. Has been marked by players seemingly checking out, like buying in, but then all of a sudden, the second something goes wrong, checking out on him just as quickly. And listen, today and how they played in terms of the game itself, it was great. They started fast. They got points on the first drive, which has been hard to come by this year. But overall, just I feel like I won't shut up about, like, listen, I love the Eagles. I bleed green. But I'm one of those people that until Nick Sirianni wins a Super Bowl, he is the reason why they will not win a Super Bowl. If he can stay out of his way and keep these players on track and win one, I'll change my tune. But he hasn't done it yet. And the thing is, they have too much talent to not win it. Because you have every a top three roster in the NFL.
You know what it reminds me of? This is gonna sound really weird, but you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of not my second experience in retail, but my first experience in retail. at a place that should remain nameless for the sake of this. Because when I think of Nick Sirianni, I think he said, I think Jamie Erdahl said it on Good Morning Football. I could be wrong. It was somewhere like Good Morning Football or Kay Adams or something like that. And they were basically talking about how coaches like Sirianni are CEOs because they don't they're not necessarily hands-on in the day-to-day, meaning playbooks and like play calling, because he relinquished those duties. But they're the CEO. They're the culture guy. They're the guy that sets the foundation, right? And particularly, well, in any line of business, right? This is any line of business. This is just for me in retail. When you have a bad CEO or a bad manager, guess what happens? People get angsty. People get stressed. People get scared. People get worried. People get frustrated, and ultimately people leave. And in football, you can't necessarily leave unless you request a trade in the sense, and we'll get more into Devondre Campbell and all those pieces tomorrow, because this it kind of ties in, but I kind of want to save that for tomorrow, as we'll kind of have less to talk about because the games tomorrow are pretty terrible. Thanks, ESPN. That's going to be bad tomorrow. Anyway, when you are in a situation, I'm sure you've experienced this with some of your work as well, and we talked about it even with our previous sports jobs as well, like our previous NFL jobs. Like, when you don't have good management, it kills you. Like, it kills you at the end of the day. And whenever I see, like today specifically, I was looking at Sirianni's demeanor. He looks like he hates his players all the time. I've never seen that. But he genuinely looks like he just hates his players and hates his team. And that, to me, is really weird.
I've thought about it. Like, it's weird because he runs so hot and so cold. It's like, when the team is kind of struggling, he kind of gets, like, flustered, can't answer questions, kind of, like, you know, looks lost. But then when the team's winning, he's like, or, you know, the team says they, you know, they claim that they love him. I don't think they do. But they claim that they love him. You know, he kind of looks happy on the sideline. I'm like, basically, this is why I say that it's because of him that the Eagles didn't win in 22. I mean, yeah, we can say the defense, which I still think is the biggest part of it. But when his emotions, you are what your team is. Like, the Lions are what Dan Campbell is. The Niners are what Kyle Shanahan is. Like, you know, your team, when you have a certain identity, you are what your head coach is. This Eagles team is what Nick Sirianni is. They can win, but it's never pretty. It's always ugly. It's a little bit confusing, but they still win. But it's like, they should be doing more.
Yeah.
And they should be acting out of a better place.
And let me bump this up really quick. You're going to like this, because I think we talked about this before, but I'm not so sure that we talked about it in a good while. And I want to bring this back around again to something that's even more important. Detroit, right? Dan Campbell. Mm-hmm. What's the city about? What's the media like in Detroit? It's very aggressive. Well, the media not as much, but I'm just talking about city and culture. I'll get to the media piece in a second. But like Detroit is very aggressive, very gritty, right? Like, that's what the Lions are. They're what the city is, right? That's a perfect example. But then Philly, Nick Sirianni, to me, doesn't seem like a Philly guy. And that's why I think the fans don't respect him, because they're just like, this guy doesn't represent our city, our culture, our approach to things. And then you think about, and you know this, especially if you're a Sixers fan, which I know you aren't, Brandon, but like, if you're an Eagles fan, you're, you know, there's obviously you probably live in Philly. You're an Eagles fan, you're a Phillies fan, and you're an Eagles fan. We're talking about Philly, and we're talking about where you are in the New York, New Jersey area. The media has expectations, has ideas that, whether how crazy or outlandish they might be, and you and I have talked about that before, you know, in the show, in private, like how the media can be, particularly in Philly, he doesn't, he can't even handle the media right. And in you're in a city like Philly, where the media is very hard to deal with. And then what does that turn into? AJ Brown says a message to the media that, you know, can blow out of proportion potentially. And yeah. Brandon Graham. It's because of Sirianni. And, like, because he can't handle the media, how does he expect his players to handle it? Right?
Because, you know,
why do you think Dallas is bad with the media? Because Jerry Jones can't fucking handle it. So it goes down to the head coach and everything else. But yeah, it's like, that's another thing for me. It's like, Philly is a very stern area. It's a very stern media complex. Because if you don't win, you're out. We're done.
Yeah.
It's so stern.
You know, like, you know why for years. I mean, at the end, people soured on him, but in retrospect, and while he was there before it got bad, people loved him, and that was Andy Reid. People loved Andy Reid. You know, Andy Reid was, he wasn't, it's funny because he was, you know, he was born and raised pretty much in LA, but he fit, his demeanor fit Philly. He was kind of, you know, no nonsense, you know, didn't, you know, but wasn't goofy, wasn't, you know, wasn't seen as kind of like a jokester, wasn't, you know, kind of a, you know, he didn't treat the players like a best friend. He treated them like he was their coach, like he coached them hard.
And didn't flip flop back and forth like a crazy human.
Yeah. And, you know, and like Nick Sirianni, one week, like his answers that he gives to me, like to the media, always confuse me because I'm like, what is he trying to say? I don't, you know, they always say, like, you know, certain coaches don't mince words. Mike Tomlin, I figured out
what he's trying to say. He feels like he can't say, because Mike Tomlin, you brought up Mike Tomlin, right? Mike Tomlin, he goes up in the media and he says what he says. He doesn't care because he knows his players respect him. What I think is happening is that there's a loss in translation between him. Let me know if I'm on the right track. There's a loss of translation between him and his players, like the direct line of communication. So he's trying to respond weirdly to the media to not get caught to his players. And then in response, his players are responding by being blunt to the media. There's clearly no direct line between what he's saying. There's no communication between him and the players. So the reason why it's weird, I think, is because it's happening through the media as like a third party. It's disgusting.
Yeah, there's no lockstep with the team. Like Lions, Dan Campbell and his players echo the same sentiments back and forth. Mike Tomlin and his players echo the same sentiments back and forth. Kyle Shanahan and his players echo the same sentiments back and forth. They're like the same person. That's why I keep saying your head coach is your team.
Bill Belichick, who's now at UNC, which he's going to do the same thing at UNC. Like, my favorite example is Mac Jones. Mac Jones was a very lively guy at Alabama. Then when he started, like, really becoming, well, obviously he fell off, but when he was really the starter his rookie year, he didn't say crap because he was with Belichick in his system. And Drake May is kind of doing similar things as well. But it's more Drake May's demeanor as a whole, and obviously Jerod Mayo is a different thing. But again, Patriot Way is kind of like that anyway. But continue, because I think that's important.
Because I look at how Jalen Hurts. If you look at every quarterback, Brock Purdy and Shanahan will say the same kinds of things. Goff and Dan Campbell will say the same kinds of things. Russell Wilson and Mike Tomlin, they're both veterans, like veterans. They'll say the same kinds of things. I look at Jalen Hurts, I look at Nick Sirianni. It's not the same sentiment. It's not the same demeanor either. It's different. They're winning and it looks pretty from a distance, but when you zoom in, it's just not. And like I said, if they win a Super Bowl, that's all I care about. Obviously, as a fan, and also just as someone who knows what the potential of this team is, that's the ultimate goal. But I look at Nick Sirianni, and the one word that keeps coming to my mind when I think about how he gives answers to the media and how he kind of conducts himself, where the players, they had to have a closed-door meeting, because I think Aaron Andrews even said this right before the broadcast, right before the game kicked off today. She said that the Eagles had a closed-door meeting to discuss, the, like, to air out their grievances, pretty much.
They did that, like, twice this year. Didn't they do that, like, the first month of the season?
Well, one I think was just the players, and I think the other one was the full team. So, but here's the thing: a 12-2 football team shouldn't be going through that. So, that's what a 2-12 football team goes through, not a 12-2. So, the one thing that I think about when it comes to Sirianni, and the thing is, he's not the one dictating these meetings. He'll lay out a game plan like the other head coaches do. He'll lay out, you know, what, you know, what he sees in the team and things like that. But it seems like, you know, like the players don't fully buy in like they do other head coaches. And the one thing I think about, the one word I associate with Nick Sirianni is paranoia. It feels like he's looking over his shoulder constantly.
And you know who's looking over his? Jeffrey Lurie.
Yeah.
You know he's thinking the same thing as we are. At least in the back of his mind, he is. He's hearing it in, like, Philly, you know, media. Like, they listen to the damn radio.
Yeah, like, you know, like if this team falls short again, and if anything is, it's not just falling short. If they fall short in a cataclysmic way, if they look bad in a really bad in a playoff game, it's gonna grow louder that Nick Sirianni can't win the big one. That he might not be cut out to be the head coach of this team. That there's the issues are repeating themselves. So. That's why I'm saying that winning cures all, because as long as they can win a ring, it won't matter. But the thing is, can they? We don't know, because it's just like my confidence level in him is just wavered. It's like one week I'm like, wow, he really stayed out of his way and answered questions thoroughly. Like, he didn't have a good presser this week. Like, this was the first presser, I think, in the 4 years, well, yeah, 21, 22, yeah, in the 4 years that he's been Eagles head coach, this was the first presser where both him and his players were in lockstep. And I feel like that's why you got the product you did today. You got a relatively clean, really good, well-played football game from this football team against a very good football team. But it doesn't happen every week. And the biggest, then the thing is, I think Sirianni is looking over his shoulder, but I also think, you know, you already know it's going to sound like a Jalen Hurts quote when I say this, but you can't keep looking over your shoulder when you're too busy trying to get to where you got to go, where you want to be.
Yeah. Yep.
So, you know, you can't be looking over your shoulder in the rear view when you're driving down the highway, you know, speeding towards a championship. You can't be doing that, because when this team is as talented as what they are and as good as what they are, and they've got guys who have, you know, won a ring, like Lane Johnson has that ring, BG has that ring, you know, and all these guys, AJ Brown, Devontae Smith, CJ Gardner-Johnson, they've played in the Super Bowl. So these guys have been there on the biggest stage. They know what it takes to win, and that's what sets them apart from other teams that might struggle with this kind of communication between their coaching staff. This is why I kept saying talent bails out bad coaching, because this team has the experience and the talent to win it all, and until these guys grow old and retire, that will always be the case, because that's how talented this core of guys is. But the biggest thing is that, you know, you can't be looking behind you at certain things when you're trying to look in front of you at what's next to accomplish even bigger goals.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. It's important to know where you've been, but you can't harp on it. You can't dwell on where you have to look at where you've been to know where you need to get to, but you can't keep constantly staring at it, because eventually it will catch up to you and it will pass you. So it's, you know, I sound like a Jalen Hurts quote, but, like, you know what's funny? That sounds exactly like something that Jalen Hurts would say.
Yeah, pretty much.
So,
yep.
So, you know,
it's pretty straightforward. I think the media is affecting him. I think the players are affecting him. And ultimately, I think Jeffrey Lurie is affecting him. He knows that if he makes a mistake, like a really bad one, Even more conversations are going to be had internally in that building. So I think that's important.
Yeah.
Do we want to get really quickly to how Sam Howell's been performing in this game? Because I feel like he's just kind of been thrown into the fire here. And it's been rough. Because, I mean, he's definitely like a project for Seattle. And that's kind of what we're seeing. But, of course, being thrown into the fire against the Packers defense is rough here. Like, it just is. Like, that's very difficult.
Yeah, you can't ask a guy to come in week 15 and try to win you a game when you're already down by a lot, you know, like, and he hasn't had the reps. So, you know, it's not like you're prepping your backup quarterback for this, you know, all season.
Yeah. So it's definitely rough. The decision making is rough, but at the same time, yeah, as you said, like, it is week 15. This is just, it feels like more of a bump in the road than anything, but yeah, they definitely view him as a project. That's kind of what I'm learning from watching it, which is fair, but yeah, it's not great.
But, you know, I still like it. Like, that's the thing. I still like Sam Howell. He just needs a chance to kind of not be pigeon-held as this back. Like, this is why we kept saying we want to see what he's made of, because Geno Smith ain't it.
Yeah,
like
I'd rather see him in a game where he has like a full game plan and prep behind him than this.
Like if this team doesn't I don't care about them winning a division or whatever it is. If this team can't make somewhat of a, like, if this team can't win a playoff game, I don't think there's any way you can have Geno Smith start next year. So, like, Sam Howell is gonna need a chance. The kid is still young. He's basically our age. Like,
yeah,
he needs a chance to start, because we saw what he could do in Washington when he was given nothing to really work with.
And he still had a pretty good season. So, yeah, this is just sucky, because I feel like people in Seattle, like, they're going to be like, he's terrible. I'm like, yeah, I mean, but also you're a young player and you're getting thrown into the Packers defense. Like, that's a tall task to without a game plan, all these different things. So that's. I'm agreeing with you on a lot of these things tonight, but that one especially, where it's like, I'm not sure what more we could expect, to be truthful here. My reverting back to my last dumb thing. Jonathan Taylor. And I could list so many more, but they can't come off the top of my head because it happens every damn year. Why, oh why, oh why, oh why are you dropping the football before you get in the end zone and making it a touchback? Why do they drop the football? Why is this not talked about in meetings? Why does this always seem to be ignored, Brandon? This is a huge problem that has been going on for what feels like our entire football lives, and no coaches sit there in a meeting and go, hey, you're about to score, keep your damn hands on the ball. That basically lost them the game. The Broncos went on, what, a 24-point run after that? Or something, like, yeah. Whatever? Like, they went on a run to win the game, is basically my point. What are we doing, dude? Why is this such a problem in all levels, but particularly in the NFL still?
It's crazy. You know how coaches, and at any level, they preach, you know, ball security, ball security, ball security, right? But but they're always saying, like, you know, like fumbles, like, you know, forced fumbles, and they, like, they're preaching, or like drops and things like that when it comes to ball security. But why don't they harp on those plays that happen like that, where the guy is dropped? Because that does happen a few times a year. So
it happened
it
twice
make sense.
Today. It happened twice today too. I mean, yeah. I forgot. The other one, I could look it up, but it happened twice today in pretty crucial moments in two separate games. But I think the Jonathan Taylor one is really important, because to me, that's what cost the damn game.
Like, it's just players always say, like, and I've heard this before, that when they've dropped the ball, you know, before the goal line, hey, you know, either A, I thought I was in, or whatever it was, like, especially when you've pulled away from a defense, it takes two. Like, you got to know where you are on the field at all times. You got to have that awareness of where you are. You can't just say you think you were in. You have to know. Like, to me, I wouldn't stop running until I'm within, like, 5 feet of the goal line. Not goal line, goal post.
Like, dude, the just like, post. like, basically where
run
the...
One through.
Well, not only that, to make it simple, right? Where that letter is on the field, basically. Oh, it was in the Bengals game. Right. It was in the Bengals game. Yeah. It was in the Bengals game because I believe it was an interception and then he dropped it. Yeah. Dude, like, and also I think he just muffed it from the Bengals perspective here that I'm looking at. I apologize if it bleeded through, but I was just looking at this. And JT just literally dropped it. It's like, dude, just run to like the halfway point of the end zone. Like, what are we doing? Like, just run to the halfway mark. Like, not even the goal, just the halfway point. Just run through. Like, you're right. Like, as you said, like, yeah, it's kind of like running through a tackle. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Like, every time I've ever seen an end zone when I've played, you know, in, like, when I just played even backyard football, my friends, like, when we've played down our local field, which is a regulation size field, we've played on that field. I can't tell how many times I've seen my friends, like, nobody's ever fumbled the ball before the goal line. We've always made sure that if we're running in there and then we're coming back to celebrate with our teammates, that's it. Like, it's not something that you just forget, especially when you're paid millions of dollars to play this game.
This is not rocket. This is not Elon Musk rocket science. It's not. Get in the end zone. Keep the football. What are we doing here?
It happens too much. And it's like, you know, guys are so focused on their celebrations before they score. It's like, score first and then celebrate. You don't celebrate and then score. Like,
because then you lose track of the football.
No. Yeah. And I, like, you know, to me, like, and, you know, we've always said that, you know, one of the biggest things when it comes to football is, hey, when the ball's in your hands, you hold that thing like for dear life and you don't stop running until you are firmly in the end zone. That's like, that's one of the things they teach you as a little kid in Pee Wee is, like, if you've got the ball, if the ball is in your hands on a live play, you don't stop running and you tuck that ball for dear freaking life. Oh, Sam Howell.
That was awful. That was just really bad. He wasn't even open.
Jesus, I just got done saying how much I think he's a good kid, and Jesus, he makes me look bad on the pod by immediately doing that.
Yeah, same with me. We're in lockstep with Sam. That was rough. See, this is why it's kind of fun to do SNF live reactions when the game isn't good, because you get to hear us kind of freak out in real time about all this crap.
Oh my god, man. Even looking at the overhead view, there was three Packers in the area and the tight end wasn't even looking for the ball. Noah Fant was not even turned around for the ball. He wasn't even out of his break yet.
What? Yeah, like come on. I bet you he just didn't see the defender, which happens a lot. But yeah.
I mean, you don't see three of them? You don't see the safety over the top, the linebacker and the DB waiting for him? Like, Jesus.
I think that felt like a panic throw to me. Yep. Yikes.
That just felt like he needed a big play.
What did we say? We do it live. We can talk about how much we love a guy and then there you go. I mean, I still love him. I do think as what we talked about earlier still stands, but yeah, that was rough.
I think about, you know, you always got to make sure, like, what did we talk about? What was it last week? You know, you never leave things up to chance in sports in general. You always make sure that you basically confirm, you know, like, it's like in the military when you have, you know, certain targets you have to kill, you have to confirm the kill. It's like, it's in sports. You have to confirm what you just did. Don't leave it up to doubt. Don't leave it up to chance. None of that. You make sure you finish what you started. And it's, these are simple, just life lessons, not even sports. And the fact that these guys are paid millions of dollars to do it, and they don't, like, they're like, oh yeah, everybody's human. But the thing is, if I did that mistake at my job, I'd be fired.
these guys can make that mistake and come back next week and still get paid $1 million more or more. Yeah, however much they get paid.
With the TD thing, right, in specific, which we're kind of transitioning back to, like, there's no one around you. There's no one around you. That there's a difference if there's a guy chasing you, but there's nobody around you and you're dropping it. It's not a hot potato.
And the thing is, as a football player, you're aware, like, not always, but 99% of the time, you have to be aware as a football player where you're on the field. They always say that, no matter what sport it is, forget football, no matter what sport, you've got to be aware of where you are on the field. These guys know, once they hit that second level, they know how many guys that there's left to beat. You don't got to beat everybody. Like, you know there's 11 guys in that defense. You've already basically kept track. You've blown through the line of scrimmage. You've blown through the linebackers. You only have, like, two guys left to beat in most cases, one or two guys left to beat. So once you beat them, you know you're gone. Get into the damn end zone and then worry about celebrating.
Yeah.
It's
the ball. It's not a hot potato. Like that, the Bengals one. If that one felt like it was like a hot potato, I was like, what the hell is going on here? So, yeah.
They always say you got to treat, like, I remember one of my peewee coaches had said this to me. You got to treat the ball like it's your baby. Don't drop it. Don't kick it around. Don't let anything happen to it. It's like your child. You hang on for that thing for dear life, and you hold it close to you. And you don't let it out of your sight either, which is what happened there. He's busy trying to celebrate. You're letting the ball out of your sight before you get into the end zone. So
what we're talking about, flow of the game, right? We did that a couple weeks ago. We seem to do that every week because, again, flow of the game matters. You preach on flow of the game. The reality is with the Jonathan Taylor thing is I think with 90% certainty that completely flipped the game. If he gets in there, the game is way different. It's a way different ball game.
We were talking about it before, you know, when that game was happening. We even said, you know, that's a hell of a catch by Romeo Doubs.
That's sick.
But we even said it, you know, when that game was happening, when you told me that it was 20-7 Colts. And I was like, I even said to you, damn, I picked the Broncos to win that game. You're like, yeah, so did I. And you're like, oh, wait, it's coming back because Jonathan Taylor didn't get into the end zone with it, didn't cross the goal line with it. So I was like, okay, 13-7. I'm like, oh, that's a big swing because that's a momentum shift. That plays like that are a momentum shift. And that's what that was. So it just happens. And I don't know why it continues to happen. It's like, these are things that are easily correctable. And players know this, that there's plenty of history plays, you know, Deshaun Jackson dropping the ball against Dallas. Like, there's been plenty of plays in history where they tell you, you know, the same story. Don't lose track of the ball when you're getting near the end zone. So I don't get it.
Yeah. Like, ultimately, it can be the simple things that lose you a ball game. And to me, that was the simplest. So there you go. Is there anything else from the weekend of football that kind of strikes your fancy? That's all I got. We're here close to the playoffs. I don't feel the need really to talk about Jets Jaguars. I know their GM thing. I kind of want to see how that unfolds before we kind of talk about that in depth. Cowboys, Panthers, whatever. Commanders won a pretty close one, but I'll be honest, the Saints played really bad. Bengals, Titans with all those penalties and turnovers and whatever. That was nuts. But I don't really have anything like that crazy to say about it. Like, is there anything else that kind of strikes you a little bit here?
From today, I mean, I don't know. I mean, Jets Jaguars being a mess.
You know what? Let me say this. The because we're getting later in the year, this is more and more common. But the early window was an absolute mess. It was bad. It was a really bad early window. And I mean, I get it was kind of purposeful, but Jesus, it was silly at times how bad it was. That early window was rough. It really was. It was really rough. So I think that's kind of the main thing is that early window was tough. Yeah, it was tough.
It, you know, when I think about how bad, you know, like, I can't remember, I think, a time this season where, I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't remember an early window being as bad as that. That would be the worst early window of the season.
Yeah, we have a couple of bad early windows. I know middle of the season we had a bad one. We had another one kind of sticked in between that. That one, like I was helping my mom get up. Like, my mom was like, "Hey, can you get me my yoga mat from downstairs?" And usually be like, "Oh, I'm watching this play. Hang on." I was like, "Yeah, these games suck. Let me go grab it." Like, sometimes I'm like that, but today I was like, "Dude, this early window is so boring. I just want to get to this." I think especially because we were anticipating what ended up being a really fun late window, even with games that weren't necessarily that great. It was kind of enjoyable as a whole. We were anticipating a really good just overall late window that it made the early window feel like an absolute drag even more, which I think was part of it, but yeah.
I don't know. There's got to be have we even had a week where the early window has actually been really, really good? I feel like we have, but it hasn't been often.
It hasn't been often enough that I remember it. Like, there's a reason the early window is the early window. Like, it right, you want the games later in the day, but, like, yeah, the early window is rough, for sure. We are going to do downfalls. We were talking a bit about military stuff. We're actually going to skip that to tomorrow. But we were also, you and I were going to do another movie because we spent our Saturday night, because we were bored out of our mind with no discernible college football other than Army Navy, to watch the movie Red One with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. We talked about Dwayne's kind of escapades before on this show with him peeing in a bottle, and he got paid $50 million for this movie. He ballooned the budget $50 million by himself from being late and for being late to set and all these different things. And I told you, I was like, dude, I can't watch this alone. I need someone to laugh about it with. And it was, we had a really good time with it. It was really bad, but talk about, because I'm sure you have better recollection than I do of it, because you got pretty upset about it, as did I, but just talk about some of these moments in this movie that was like, you're just like, what in the world is going on? Because I think that was just our reaction as a whole to Red One.
Coming into this, it's like, yeah, we knew our expectations were going to be pretty low, right? But I really looked at it from a standpoint of like, well, I know this movie's not going to be good, but I just hope it gives me something to kind of look forward to, something to kind of, you know, think about or come out of there feeling good about, whatever it is. I've never been more depressed at a Christmas movie in my life. And the thing is, that's because it's not a Christmas movie. It's a Christmas movie, and it's disguised. It's an action movie disguised. Oh, actually, a poorly edited, poorly shot action movie disguised as a Christmas movie. And it I mean, you said it before I even did, that it feels poorly miscast. I mean, literally, everybody feels poorly miscast in this movie except for Chris Evans.
I thought Chris Evans was really good. Like, I get people are upset at his agency for picking bad movies and they'll make a lot of money. I'll be honest, he kind of rocks in these movies. He just kind of does. Yeah. Like, he just fits it. He does.
He saved this movie for me, when we were talking about it. We were like, oh yeah, what rating would we give it? We're like, oh yeah, like, that movie would be like, you know, you were like, oh yeah, it's a 4 out of 10. I'm like, yeah, for me, it's a 3 out of 10. And it's only because there were somewhat funny moments, and because he was actually, you know, a pretty good actor for what it was worth in it. The problem was, the story sucked, dialogue sucked, the characters sucked, the editing sucked. There's only maybe one or two kind of cool set, you know, action set pieces. And it's like a movie like this, you know, a Christmas comedy action movie kind of thing. Most of them are an hour and a half, hour 45. Why was this one almost 2 hours? That's too long.
Let me go through the specific stuff too. So basically this entire movie is the gist of this entire movie. Yes, we're gonna spoil it. You don't need to see this movie. Honestly, please don't, unless you're that curious, because that was kind of what we did. So basically this whole movie is about, like, most of the world's on the naughty list because social media is stupid and whatever else. And so basically there's a witch that wants to basically trap everyone who's on the naughty list in a snow globe. Yeah, that's the part of this damn movie. And then, like, it helps Chris Evans reconnect with his son and be more nice or whatever. And then, you know, and then basically everyone gets saved at the end. And that's basically the film. But there are pieces of this movie that are just like, oh my God, that's clearly a Chevy Silverado EV advertisement placement. Why is Santa, like, fitter than Dwayne The Rock Johnson? Like, isn't he supposed to be fat? And they literally make a joke about that at the end of the movie. And then talk about that Rhode Island thing. Because that Rhode Island thing, which you can talk about what that was more thoroughly than I can. Like, that made us die of laughter of just how poorly thought out that specific line was.
Like, I get kind of what they were going for, but what was it? Like, saying that, you know, what, Krampus has Santa has, like, a naughty and nice list or whatever it is. Like, they have a longer list than the state of Rhode Island. And I'm like, if you're going to pick a state, and given how long the fictional naughty or nice list is,
it's gigantic.
You're picking the smallest state in America. Like, a state that you can drive from one end to the other to in about an hour, not even, 45 minutes, maybe less. Like, you are picking literally the smallest state in America to say that his list is longer than that. It's like, well, yeah, of course it would be. There's billions of people in the world. There's not billions of people in Rhode Island. So I'm like, you would have been better off saying, oh yeah, his list is longer than the Western Hemisphere or
California. California, Texas, yeah. Just something.
Like something, but you picked the smallest state in America. That's, you know, that's smart. But I, you know, that was just one joke that I was like, huh? I was like, that doesn't make sense.
And this entire movie is framed around the idea of Santa getting kidnapped, yet we actually don't see him getting kidnapped, like, at all. We literally don't see the scene, like, at all.
Yeah. Yeah. What, like, literally, the last scene we see him in is he's splitting cookies with Callum.
Which is splitting the Rock.
Cookies with him.
With the Rock. Yeah. That's the Rock's character.
He splits a cookie with him, and all of a sudden it just cuts to, like, the Rock walking outside of the building, you know, Santa's kind of headquarters, you know, walking around the town, the little North Pole town that it's centered in. And all of a sudden he gets the alert that, oh, Santa's all of a sudden missing. Like, the what? Like, you couldn't show it? You couldn't at least show him, like him being taken away, like, for 2 seconds? Like, not saying you have to show him actually getting taken away, but, like, show him, like, especially when he runs into the building where Santa usually is, you couldn't show, like, them hijacking Santa, like, off of the balcony, like, you know, pulling him off of it, like, pulling him away or whatever it is. Like, you could at least show that. Like, why, you know, and instead we got a really poor, like, CGI, almost cartoonish Batmobile kind of chase for a while. Like, I don't get it. It doesn't make sense how they did any of it. And I really don't know.
And here's the other part, right? This is a PG-13 movie. This movie has sexual innuendos. This movie has, what else does it have? It has guns and shooting and fight choreography, and it's very much, it's kidnapping, right? It's a PG-13 movie. But there's stuff like that where you're like, why didn't they show the kidnapping then? So you're telling me you were trying to make this PG anyway? There's sexual innuendos throughout the entire damn flipping movie. It's not a PG movie. What are you doing?
Yeah, like, I mean, we were watching it, and it's like we were just so confused. Like, it's just like the way they went about doing it almost just seemed like it was just counterintuitive and just didn't make sense. Like, it just went against everything that you would expect or any, like. And the worst part is that you're making a movie like this that's supposed to be kind of like a little different take on a Christmas movie. But the problem is it ended up being predictable anyway, because you fell into this by the third act, you fell into all the same tropes of a traditional Christmas movie.
Not only a traditional Christmas movie, of a traditional movie about saving a person.
Yeah. Yep. Like, how many times do we see, oh, this person might be saved, but the caveat is that, oh, a person close to them was also taken hostage. That happened.
You predicted that as it was happening.
Yeah. Like, I was like, because I even said in the one scene where Chris Evans vows to save, not vows, but he basically inadvertently, but also he kind of knew what he was doing. He saves the Rock's life at the hands of Krampus, and I'm like, that's gonna come into play pretty soon, because, you know, I knew that we were kind of getting towards the end of the second act. I'm like, that's gonna come into play pretty soon, because watch, the roles are gonna reverse, and he's gonna have to pretty much save Chris Evans, like something that goes wrong, you know, and the reverse, vice versa.
Yeah. So, and that's exactly what happened, like 20 minutes later.
Not even, like 10. 10 minutes, because it was so poor. The ending was so poorly rushed. It happened like 10 minutes later.
It was like 10 minutes later. And then, okay, and then the snowman thing, okay? The snowman thing. So snowmen are able to walk on a beach and start freezing people. Okay? Great. And then they realize that the way to kill the snowman is to just take the carrot off their head. That's what we're doing. Like, what? Like, what are we doing? And then, so the witch has like shapeshifter teleportation powers, like the like ghost in the MCU or like Ant-Man. Like, Dwayne Johnson has Ant-Man powers. That's the most basic power set, if it's not actually canon to a character, like it is in Marvel, for example. It's like, what are we do? Why? Like, why?
And the problem is, what's the point of having a power if, like, you know, superheroes have weaknesses, but the problem is like, and, you know, then the powers become useless. But what's the point of having a power that's not really a power? It's more like a gadget he has that he can use. What's the point of having a simple gadget, almost like an Ant-Man thing, if it doesn't work on everything the same way like the Ant-Man stuff would?
Yeah.
Like, that kind of is a little bit weird. Like, it's a limited kind of weird power to have. Then there's just so many things that are just kind of, like, inaccurate about this movie. Like, nobody's going into the toy stores are a thing of the past. Nobody's going in them, you know, like in a Toys R Us, and it's not gonna be packed on Christmas. Like,
yeah, or around Christmas.
If you would have said that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, okay, that's fine, but that's not reality. Like, the mall being packed with people on Christmas, that doesn't happen anymore.
And they're fighting and they're fighting over essential oils. Who the fuck wants to fight over essential oils?
I get that. I get that joke because it's something so stupid. And they're getting so aggressive over it. So I get that as a kind of like a joke. But it just comes off less as a joke and more as cringy dialogue that doesn't necessarily need to be there. So
who's going to a mall? Like, yeah, you can go to a mall on a weekend and it's busy. But, like, why? Like, everyone shops online anyway. Who cares?
That movie, we could spend all day on so many things that just, like, you know, some of the CGI
was very poorly done. Like, you could see either a green screen, or you could see, like, some of the editing was poor. You could see, the light. For some reason, this movie is also really dark, and I don't know why. It's supposed to be a Christmas movie, but this movie is, like the lighting is super dark. It feels like I'm watching The Batman again.
I just want to remind you that this movie cost $250 million.
And The Rock is responsible for basically half that budget.
Well, yeah, $50 million. But $250 million for some of the worst CGI you'll ever see. Ever see.
Well, I'm saying $50 million just for him alone. Then on top of the delay, that probably cost them double that budget.
Yeah. Yeah, so, no, I hear you. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So, you know, like, and to have a movie like that, like, it's like, you know, good on the actors are getting paid. Good, you know, The Rock's always going to get paid. Chris Evans going to get paid. J.K. Simmons going to get, you know, J.K. Simmons will get paid. They'll all get paid. But, like, that's a movie that, if they weren't as well known for other things, that's a movie that would easily kill your career before it even starts.
Yeah. And here's another piece of this, which I told you before we started. This movie was shot in IMAX, which also popped up the budget. And the reason why was because The Rock was so impressed with Oppenheimer. He's like, I'm going to do Red One in IMAX. You can see a lot of the set pieces. You could see why they're shot in IMAX. Like, they're shot in IMAX set pieces. But it's a Christmas movie. Why does it need to be in IMAX?
Doesn't have to be. It's just because that's you know what the Rock says goes. That's it's always been his MO throughout his entire career. Both as a wrestler as an actor, you know, it's what The Rock says goes. So, you know, the fact that The Rock had so much say in this movie is also ridiculous too.
He is the most poorly cast character in the whole movie, by the way, by a mile.
Like, listen, he's, you know, he's built an empire for himself, and no one can deny that. But, like, God, man, like, I know I said like a lot, but I'm like struggling to find the words.
Okay,
like,
can I add another piece to this while you're thinking about that? The beginning of the movie really pissed us off, because so he goes to a mall to like speak to the kids, and. And, like, by the way, everything's leather in this movie. Almost everything. Santa's clothes is leather. Everyone's wearing leather for some stupid reason. Do you associate anything leather with Christmas other than, like, your mom's purse or something?
Yeah, no.
Nope. Nobody wears leather. And then the beginning of the movie is, it looks like a Black Ops mission. Like, Santa is getting military and police escorts. And we're like, doesn't this guy have magic? Why does he need a bodyguard? Why does he need police and military escorts? Like, what is happening? And then here's the worst part about this movie. The entire, like, interior of the North Pole, like that scene when Santa gets kidnapped, there are so many people, like maintenance people, security, you know, like in the North Pole. Are you telling me there's no one guarding the outside that someone can easily take a chainsaw and get through? Yet he has a military escort? What are we doing?
I don't get it. God. And wasn't that thing that we touched on with the movie? Like, oh, they have security inside, like, the North Pole, but not near the border where it should be?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm alluding to. Yeah, like, not outside the border opening.
And then I even said to you last night, I said that's like me living in my house, locking my, because my house is technically an apartment complex, but it's not. We own the house. Like, it's three floors. It's the basement floor, which is ours, you know, the middle floor, which is the main area where we all live, the three of us live, and then the upstairs that we rent out to tenants. So it's still our house. We can still walk up there if we need to get stuff, whatever. It's not an apartment complex, it's still a house, but it's a two or three family. But that's like me locking the front door to this floor and not locking my house door or my garage in the front.
for someone to come into my house and still break into my door because I didn't lock the front door. Like, it's like that's insane to me. It's like, you know, especially with all the military things and how magical Santa is. Like, and isn't Santa kind of supposed to isn't Santa supposed to be aware of things that are going on before they like usually happen? So yeah. How is he not aware? How is he not aware of somebody coming to kidnap him, especially when they established it later on in the movie that you know, the people that abducted him, like the witch that abducted him, the ogre, you know, that they've had issues in the past.
Yeah.
So you know this is a constant, so then
what's the point of Chris Evans then, if you know that she's probably the one who did it anyway? Then what's the point of his character?
I wish I knew. I'm still 24 hours later, I wish I knew.
And then last thing before we kind of go on this, right? And finish up our night. Because Red One is saying, or Red, I guess. Red One, Red is Santa's call sign. That's the gist of this. There are so many fucking abbreviations for things. Dwayne Johnson works for a security thing called ELF, which I literally forgot what it's called. There's like an international, like, or a national mythological agency that also has a code word. Why does everything need a goddamn code word just because the movie is based on, oh, Santa's code word is red? Who cares? That the whole movie needs to be in damn code words then? This is so complex.
It also makes a movie that's supposed to be a Christmas movie. Like, Christmas movies are supposed to be simple. Like, there was, like, weird subplots here. And not only that, but when you're treating this like a military action movie, like, when you're treating this basically like The Hurt Locker, but just in Christmas form, it makes it confusing. It's like, people don't want to sit here and decipher, like, you know, the cutesy little Christmas codes, like, in the movie, like, when you're... But, like, the fact that every other word spoken in a sentence was spoken in, like, a code name for something, like, that's like talking as if we were texting. And every other thing is LOL, TBH, you know, SMH,
an emoji,
all these different things.
An emoji, yeah.
Like, it's not real dialogue. You're just using it's just sloppy writing when you're kind of using that many kind of code words or different things because of what the movie premise is. Like, that's just that you're just using that to cover up sloppy writing.
And so the writing was terrible. This script was so bad. It was so bad.
I don't even want to talk about it.
The more we talk about it, the more this is going. Like, it was at a 4 because I was like, Chris Evans was good. There was some. This is going down to like a 2 now, dude. Like, I hate this movie. I hate it.
I told you that's why I'm being generous, giving it a 3 because I would have given it a 2. Wasn't for some of the comedy and the, like.
No, the exact quote you said is, "I'll be in the Christmas spirit, and instead of giving it a 2, I'll give it a 3 in honor of the Christmas spirit." I was like, "Bruh, oh my god." Are you excited for our last Monday Night Double of the year? We have one more left.
No. I mean, yes, I'm ready for it to end, but. God.
Bears, Vikings, and Falcons, Raiders. Do we really care about any of these matchups in all honesty?
Absolutely not.
There you go.
Because if it, you know, like, I can't say much more than that because, my God, if it mattered, we would, like, I guarantee tomorrow we're going to spend probably between the two games combined, we're probably going to spend 2 minutes on each game and then just talk about the movie. And then get ready for next week. That's it.
Yeah, that's it. I have a couple of things. Like, I want to do Devondre Campbell tomorrow. Like, I have a couple things lined up that I was like, let's just save it for Monday since the games suck. But that's probably it. Like, yeah. So it's gonna be thank God it's at 5 and 5:30 Pacific and not, oh yeah, here's a game starting at 6:30. On the West Coast, like, thank God, guys, but Jesus. But yeah, I think that's all we got, Brandon. Good show as always, man.
Yeah, I think we kind of kept it, you know, pretty. I mean, hey, we had our moments tonight. So I had a couple brain farts because I was just dumbfounded by how this Seahawks game was going. But
no, yeah, which I mean, yeah, that was fun. I mean, we dove right into it because we had a lot to say today. Because today was at least that second half of the day was crazy. So there's that. And hey, we finished like insanely early, as we. That's crazy.
We started at 10 on the dot, literally. So we went basically an hour and a half. So
hour and a half, pretty much. Pretty an hour 40. So I'll take that. We'll probably do about the same tomorrow. Probably we'll see. Depends on how the games go. For Brandon, for myself, we'll see you back here on Monday. And again. Because I know it's a Chargers game, but because of the Saturday games coming up and the college football playoff and all these things, we're going to consolidate a lot of these things into Sunday and Monday moving forward, just to make it easier, because we don't want to be doing four or five shows in a week and diluting the shit. Like, I don't want to be doing that. So there we go. So
we'd be exhausted too.
Yeah, we'd be so exhausted. So. So it's going to be a Sunday Monday split moving forward, especially with the holidays coming up and all these things. We'll see what we're doing the last week. I don't know if we'll do a Saturday Sunday split. We might just do Sunday because we just want to get right into the playoff games probably, but we'll figure that out as we go. But yeah, next week or next Sunday and Monday, we're going to be all over the college football playoff games as well. I want to make sure we have time for that. So yeah, that's kind of why we're consolidating everything to that Sunday-Monday split. But we will see you tomorrow for our last Monday night double of the season, thank God. But yeah, I'm excited for it. Thank you, Brandon, and thank you for those of you who always take the time to listen here on our Sunday night extravaganzas.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, Rob. but yeah, thank you, everybody, and thank you, Rob, and hey, we're getting close into the season, so let's make it a good home stretch, shall we?
Yeah, good home stretch until we get to the playoffs. We will see you tomorrow and next Sunday as well. See you then.
Yes, sir. Take care, everybody.